But what we need to remember is there are fundamentals that don't change. If someone was trained as an engineer in the 1950s, you'd say, oh, everything's so different. It's completely different now. Nothing they learned would be applicable. Au contraire.
Who wants to talk about learning? Heidi, you want to talk about learning?
Yeah.
Well, we'll also talk to Barbara Oakley about learning. Who's Barbara Oakley? Well, she's developed some of the most innovative, popular online learning courses ever, including Learning How to Learn, Powerful Mental Tools to Help You Master Tough Subjects. Again, one of the most popular online courses called a MOOC, Jaime, Massive Open Online Course. He's also a professor of engineering at Oakland University and McMaster University, served in the U.S. Army as a signal officer, retiring as a captain. She met her husband as a radio operator in the South Pole Station in Antarctica. We'll talk about that. Numerous academic awards, including 2018's Michigan Distinguished Professor of the Year, and author of multiple books, including Learning How to Learn, Learn Like a Pro, and the book in my hand right now, which is why I reached out to Barbara, Uncommon Sense Teaching, Practical Insights in Brain Science to Help Students Learn. As we talk about the future of work, you cannot expect to be building a high-performing learning organization without making sure that you understand the mechanics of learning, to make sure that not just your HR team, but every manager, every coach throughout your organization knows how to coach and develop people, especially at a time when it's so critical to get people skilled up and reskilled quickly in this workforce climate. So we talked to Barbara. We touched on a bunch of topics on everything from retrieval practice to how online learning can be just as effective as in-person, to talking about some just general myths about how learning works. I'm done talking. Let's hear what Barbara has to say. Here's Barbara Oakley. Let's bring it in. Well, Barbara, Uncommon Sense Teaching, and I know you have a lot of other books that you have released over the years. What made you write this book?
Well, so I did this course with Terry Sinowski, who's a very prominent neuroscientist, called Learning How to Learn. And we've had over 3 million students. It's one of the most popular online courses in the world. And people kept writing to me and saying, okay, this is great for students, but what if you're a teacher? How do you help your students as a teacher so they can learn more effectively? And at first I thought, well, you know, I don't really want to get into that area. But then the more I learned over the years, the more I began to realize, oh, well, actually there's a lot from neuroscientists that can help us as whether you're in business and you're trying to advise and help your company to and your company's workers to learn more effectively, or your vocational training, whatever you're trying to help onboard students with, there's a lot that we know from neuroscience that can help you as either an administrator or an instructor to more effectively and efficiently impart new information.
The book is full of strategies, you know, and I don't think I can really share my copy with any of my friends or colleagues because it's all marked up. There's a lot of highlights, you know, there's different, right. But I'm interested to know, is there any one strategy or tactic that you find, you know, is a fan favorite from teachers? And as you've gone around and talked about the book, is there any like single tactic that was a game changer for a teacher?
Well, for students, the game changer is the Pomodoro technique, which is just putting aside all distractions, setting a timer for 25 minutes, working as effectively as you can for those 25 minutes, and then taking a 5 minute or so break, a real break. And that has been a game changer for learners all over the place. Now for teachers, the game changer is retrieval practice, which I know, you know, is and make it stick. It's a huge discussion, but we know now even more from neuroscience about why retrieval practice, which is just trying to remember something without looking at whatever that something is. So you're not just rereading a page, for example, you're looking away from the page to see what the key ideas were, or using flashcards to check whether something's in your brain. And it turns out that every time you check like this, test yourself, that you're actually strengthening the neural connections between, you know, the neurons that connected neurons in long-term memory is, that's the be-all and end-all of learning. And each time you retrieve an idea, you're actually strengthening things. So, for example, I was just in San Francisco, and there they were giving an award to a rural school district in Delta, Colorado, that is just doing phenomenally well with their students. And the reason is because they switched to retrieval practice, like asking students to come up with things themselves. And this includes even even things like multiplication tables, which, you know, we've long been taught, oh, no, you never have to memorize those things. You can always just look it up. But it turns out you can't build the neural structure of understanding unless you have those facts readily available. And in business terms, this relates to, like, let's say you're learning to code. Well, you memorize those hotkeys, so you have instant mental access. Sure, you can always look them up, but what's the use? I mean, good coders are good coders because they've got instant access in their mental Rolodex to these important, you know, seemingly minor, but actually quite important ways of expediting their work.
On that point on retrieval practice, I mean, just, I think when you read your book and you look at the research, it just makes sense, but it's still not widely adopted. Or, like, I'll find having conversations with folks who just don't, like, there's like a neuro myth that they just don't believe it. How do you respond to that? How do you talk through with someone to maybe change their point of view? Is there anything that's worked most effectively for you?
Oh yeah, imagery. So, for example, I went out and spoke about 4 years ago to that Delta, Colorado school. And I remember, you know, when I brought up the phrase multiplication tables, all the teachers, there were about 400 teachers in the room, and all the ones in the back and so forth, they started stomping their feet and hooting and hollering because they thought I was going to say, and you don't need to, you know, no rote learning of memory, you know, of the multiplication tables is ever needed. They thought I was going to say that. And they hear it so often from professional development trainers and so forth, that it's almost like this call and response. The trainer will allude to something that will make them think, and I'm going to disparage, you know, retrieval practice, especially of something like the multiplication tables. And instead, what I just said, as I paused, as the hooting and hollering died down, and I said, I am not here to tell you what you want to hear, because people want to hear it. It's easier to not do retrieval practice and not insist on it in your students. I said, I'm not here to tell you what you want to hear. I'm here to tell you what you need to hear. And you could have heard a pin drop. And I think that, you know, there's resistance to the idea because it's harder and because they haven't been told that that's important, you know, by previous experts in the field who had a vested interest in doing things the way they've always been taught themselves to do things. You know, and it's really hard. Let's say you're some expert that's been out there preaching to the choir for the last couple decades. You know, you don't want to suddenly say, well, you know, I've been wrong for 20 years. And based on modern neuroscience, you know, here's these new ideas. So there's still a lot of this older set of ideas out there. And, it's hard for people to change sometimes.
And we'll see that with organizations who maybe had, you know, they invested in technology and, you know, infrastructure that, you know, whether it's learning platforms a decade ago that, to your point, as you read something like this, it challenges maybe some of the software and some of the teaching methods you have in place. And it's tough, you know, it costs money. It requires people to raise their hand and say that, to your point, you know, I have to be willing to change. When you look at technology, I know so much of the book also talks about online, you know, there's online learning, and now with COVID and online learning is, you know, even changed more. What are there any trends that excite you about software or technology that are adopting these principles?
Oh, well, first I have to tell you about my favorite athlete of all time. His name is Julius Yego. And Julius is from Kenya. He always wanted to throw the javelin, but if you know anything about Kenya, you know it's like, that's not done there. They are long distance runners primarily. But Julius had his own ideas, but he was poor, couldn't go overseas to study. There weren't any javelin throwing coaches in Kenya. So he started watching great instructors online. And 98% of the time, simply by watching these great instructors and going out and practicing on his own, he became the world champion in throwing the javelin. So sometimes I get a little, let's just say miffed at online, those who are, I mean, for a long time, there's been this huge pushback that online learning is always inferior to learning face-to-face, which is simply not true. And COVID has muted some of the criticism, but at the same time, a lot of academicians are threatened by online learning. And so you'll hear from big professors who will sit and pontificate for half an hour with a picture of their book beside them about how bad, you know, how online learning isn't. I mean, it's okay, but it's not comparable to face-to-face. And they're sitting there the whole half an hour just with their book beside them. And you want to say, you know, that's bad online teaching. You're exemplifying why you think it's, you know, bad, because anybody watching you is going to say, well, this is bad instruction. And so of course you're going to always think that it's inferior. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, it's, people will push the idea of, okay, you've got to have learners engaging with the materials and with each other. You really want engagement with one another. In some sense, that's a cop-out. It's like, you know, you should be having your students talking to one another on discussion forums and so forth. And if they're not learning effectively, that's why. Instead of sitting there taking a step back and going, if I want my learners to engage, why don't I make engaging videos? Why don't I make my online presentations more than just some picture sitting beside me for 10 minutes at a time? And what I see is exciting is really engaging online courses. And they're not all out there, because universities and other institutions, they can be, you know, it's a product. You want 40 hours on manufacturing processes. So you get 40 boring hours on manufacturing. There's no attention to quality as far as making it engaging. It's very little, because you're just pushing the product out the door a number of hours. But gradually things are beginning to improve, because there is competition in the online world where there really isn't that much competition in a classroom.
Yeah. Is it easier or is it harder to teach in the classroom, whether it's to young people or at the college level? Is it easier or harder in your opinion?
Oh, you know, I think it all depends on how you start. You know, if you start online, you'll think online's easier. If you start face-to-face, you'll think face-to-face is easier. So, but because most all teachers out there now have started face-to-face, it always makes me laugh when teachers will say, you really know the material when you can transfer the material. And then when it comes to teaching, all they got to do is transfer what they know about teaching from teaching face-to-face to teaching it online. So if they really know how to teach, it should be a piece of cake. They can just transfer what they know, right? Well, you know, that tells you that transfer is not all it's cracked up to be. But online teaching to me is, I love it because you can like put it together and plan it better, you know, and face-to-face, you're still planning, but it's the difference between like you go on a date for somebody, you know, you go on a date, that's like making an online course. You get it all ready. You know, if you have a cold or you're feeling bad that day, you don't go. You get yourself looking as good as you can. You know, so online learning is like dating, but in class is like marriage. You know, what you see is what you get. You can't take it back if you say something wrong, you know? And so, you know, I actually like online learning or online teaching better in the sense that I can more carefully choreograph so it really can reach the learner in a way that I think is most effective.
The other thing I was thinking about as you were talking, and also, you know, on the online learning track is, you know, in so many cities across America, there are workforce development centers that because of COVID had to close. And they had to immediately shift from a classroom model to a how do we deliver this online model? Many didn't have the infrastructure ready for it, even though they should have. Not adopting online, you know, fundamentally discriminates against a certain corner of our communities who don't have access to, you know, transportation to get down to the workforce center, or transportation to get to the community college. So I also think there's an element of, and I was kind of getting that through some of your stuff around, you talk about kids who maybe don't get access to quality education systems being at a disadvantage in a modern world. I think, you know, this is where a lot of adopting some of your principles can, potentially level the playing field if it's done right.
I think so. And I have to say, you know, they're not my principles. They're principles that grow out of what great neuroscientists have discovered, as well as cognitive psychologists, about how the brain works and how we learn effectively. So I think, you know, just a like all through the history of science, there's often a major pushback against doing something new and appropriate. For example, you know, washing hands before surgery. Well, all the surgeons were like, how dare you, insinuate that I'm a dirty person. And so they wouldn't do it, and no matter what kind of evidence was shown. And even now, so you might think, oh yeah, but that was 100 or more years ago, so that doesn't happen. It happens now. For example, Alzheimer's research. My father died of Alzheimer's, and I remember telling him, you know, researchers are working on it. Within the next few years, you know, they're saying they're right on the edge. Well, no, actually, it turned out that all the you know, virtually all of the major researchers, all the journal editors, the funding agencies, all were aligned in the idea that, you know, certain amyloid plaques were the cause of Alzheimer's. Actually, they're a symptom of Alzheimer's. They're not the cause. So that meant that we fell behind 30 years because everybody was blocking any other approach to figuring out the problem. So similarly, in education, we know now how students learn effectively. I mean, neuroscience has got all this insight, and but schools of education are not, by and large, not teaching it, and school boards are not accepting it, not promoting it. It's really, and in fact, sort of like the whole, there are major initiatives to turn directly away from what neuroscience has told us is important in learning, learning effectively. But I think for business, the biggest and most important takeaway is that online classes and online ways of learning can trump, they can beat out all those sort of like you send somebody to a 2-week boot camp or something like that. Those are super expensive. They're fun little gigs, but they actually don't space out learning effectively like good online learning can. And good online learning is much more cost effective. So, I think that that's a really exciting and positive development for, HR, who's trying to keep the workforce, up to the times and beyond.
Sure. And on that front, future of work, jobs are going to be changing at a rate. The tasks that make up work is going to consistently change even at a faster and faster rate. You can make the argument, we got to get better at being effective learners, all of us, whether we're managers or, participants or students or workers.
Oh, that's so very true. And part of that is we want to be, but what we need to remember is there are fundamentals that don't change. If someone was trained as an engineer in the 1950s, you'd say, oh, everything's so different. It's completely different now. Nothing they learned would be applicable. Au contraire. Those fundamental engineering, getting those ideas in mind, that you've got it, you can far more easily transition than you can if you were someone who is trying to come at programming without an engineering background.
Do you think that's very similar to the way some people will say millennials learn different or Gen Z learns different? Or I have a 5-year-old daughter, and now people are Gen Alpha learns different. I mean, is there anything to that?
If you're trying to make a lot of money as a consultant, yeah, then it's completely different. And by the way, I've got a solution for you about this very different way of learning. But, the reality is everybody learns through retrieval practice. They like visual sorts of learning. It helps to teach people how to stay away from too much social media. A modicum is good, but if you get addicted, then that's a problem. So, come on. The brain is not really changed between Gen Z and my brain. And they learn by making the same connections in long-term memory, and retrieval practice will help with that.
Barbara, last question for you. Talking about future of work, what is your hope for the future of work?
Oh, gosh.
An easy question.
No, I wish it was easy to implement, but I really want to see the disadvantaged have access to the same quality education that those who are really advantaged can have. Because I volunteered for 5 years in an inner urban school district. The kids were great and they could fully learn. And some of those kids they'd never even had a homework problem, corrected in their entire educational career. It's a travesty what is experienced by some students going through that. So, and there's so many jobs for those who can, who are, willing enough to feel uncomfortable during the training process, the remedial training process, which is what I had to go through when I was learning. I was terrible at math and science growing up. I literally flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science. And age 26, I started with remedial high school algebra. And now I'm a distinguished professor of engineering. So it tells you, you know, be comfortable with being uncomfortable, start low, start slow, keep going, be persistent, and you can be amazed at what you can do.
Barbara, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So I got to say, you know, if you haven't already, you have to pick up Uncommon Sense Teaching. You know, it's one of these books that you just mark the whole thing up, and it's no doubt gets deep on the science of how learning works. But again, at the same time, I think there's no more important skill set and topic to wrap our head around as leaders than the deep science of how learning works as a fundamental background. You know, some of the stuff Barbara said that stuck with me, the content needs to be engaging. Thinking about how the learning that we're sharing is in of itself its own product. She also talked about how there's very little attention given to the quality of content today, but that is gradually changing. And that is gradually changing for the better. And I'll end on one highlight I have in her book, Uncommon Sense Teaching, which you should go to your local bookstore and pick up, that I think is another thing we should be thinking about as we're thinking about the future of work. Barbara says this: children without access to quality education systems, or those discouraged by either their family or culture from taking advantage of the type of learning that quality education systems provide, are at a disadvantage in the modern world. Their brains don't get the, quote, repurpose training that lies at the heart of a good education. What's the result? As older students and adults, they can find it challenging to grapple with ideas and skills that others with a better education find straightforward. As leaders and coaches in the future of work, it is our responsibility to dismantle discrimination. And part of that means that we dismantle the ways that education may have been designed that keep people out. And this is our opportunity in the future of work to root the things that we're teaching, the ways that we're developing our workers, the ways that we're developing our teams and our people, not just in great content, but great science. Another reason why you should pick up all of Barbara's books: Uncommon Sense Teaching, Practical Insights in Brain Science to Help Students Learn. And don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not gonna wanna miss. Now, back to work.